Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Good, Bad, the Ugly, the Aviation Maintenance Industry. I am your host, Brian Wheels, and you're listening to 2023's first Aircraft Tech Talk. Yay! It's finally here. And it's been a while, I know, since we've had an Aircraft Tech Talk segment, and I'm glad you guys are tuning in. I've accumulated some great questions from listeners asking aircraft technical questions, and we're going to answer them right here. First Aircraft Tech Talk of 2023 coming up. Hello again, everybody, and thanks so much for tuning in to 2023's first Aircraft Tech Talk of the year. Aircraft Tech Talk has really become popular, and it's the top three episodes in the podcast still since we started this in 2021. We're going to answer some of your really great questions here, so let's dive in. This first Aircraft Tech Talk question comes from Kyle in Indiana, and Kyle writes, Brian, what does an APU do on an airplane exactly? We're stuck at the gate for almost an hour here waiting because the APU won't start according to the pilots. What gives? Do they provide just electricity and hydraulic pressure? Kyle, that's a great question. Thanks so much for writing in. So the APU, or the auxiliary power unit, it's a small turbine engine. APUs have been in use since, stemming back to World War II, they were called putt-putts. They're almost always located in the tail of the aircraft, although the 727, for example, has it in the wheel well. And they provide a source of pneumatic and electrical power to the aircraft in addition to the batteries and the generators located on the aircraft engines. They do not provide a direct source of hydraulic power, though, but they provide a source of electrical power for the electrical hydraulic pumps. Also, in case if you're wondering or if others are wondering, they do not add any propulsion component to the aircraft. Some RATs or ram air turbines can provide a backup source of limited hydraulic power and or electrical power or both for the aircraft in an emergency situation. APUs, though, they're not just used on aircraft, believe it or not. They can be found on ships and large land vehicles such as tanks. Generally, APUs produce about 115 volts AC at about 400 hertz, although there are some that can produce 28 volts DC as well. And this is to supplement the aircraft's electrical system, and they can be used as a backup to run a limited amount of aircraft systems during an emergency. APUs, though, they are a single or a three-phase system. The major manufacturers are Honeywell, Pratt & Whitney, and Safran right now. APUs can be used at the gate, and they usually are to provide power on the aircraft for ground ops, but many larger airports have dedicated GPUs or ground power units to provide ground power for the aircraft instead, because you don't want an APU running at the gate. You want to be annoying the people in the terminal, people on the ramp, and it saves fuel costs as well. So likely what happened to the aircraft that you were on is the crew tried to start the APU and it failed on them at the gate. Now, since this failure occurred, they probably had maintenance come to the aircraft. Actually, they did have maintenance come to the aircraft and troubleshoot the problem, and you didn't indicate whether it was fixed or not, but you wouldn't necessarily know, so I don't blame you. Maintenance probably put the APU on MEL, that's the minimum equipment list, and I talked about MELs in episode 13, so that's a good source of information, and you might want to check out that episode. The APU, though, is not necessarily needed on the aircraft. It's not a safety-sensitive item, and many aircraft, they don't require the APU to be functional for a safe flight, and that's nice to know because it's not a requirement, so you're A-okay safe there. APUs, they can be used in conjunction with the aircraft engines when they're running, by themselves, or in an emergency. Generally, though, modern APUs used in flight, they can be used up to the service ceiling of the aircraft. Some, though, are limited by the altitude of the aircraft in which they can be started and run. Hopefully, Kyle, that does answer your question. In short, I do appreciate you writing in. Thank you so much, Kyle. And this next question comes from Marcus L. in San Francisco, California. And Marcus writes us, hey, Brian, I started listening to your podcast 3 months ago on my way to work, and I find it really interesting and honest. Why do airplanes use jet fuel instead of gas? Is it more flammable? Thanks. Marcus, thanks for writing in, and kudos, and I do appreciate you reaching out. So there are several reasons why, and I'll try to keep it brief, because you can go into a long, drawn-out discussion on aviation fuel, why it is used, what it's comprised of, and the properties of it, et cetera, et cetera. Aviation fuel is essentially formed by compiling the properties of petroleum and kerosene and some other synthetic blends that go into it. And you have two main types of fuel. You have avgas and jet gas. And with jet gas, there's derivatives of it, such as Jet A, Jet A1, and Jet B. And Jet A is primarily used here in the U.S. It's a pretty heavy fuel, and it has a higher flash point and a freezing point than your standard kerosene-based fuel. While Jet A1 or Alpha 1 is more of a worldwide type of fuel, it has an even lower freezing point than Jet A, and it's used primarily on aircraft that are going to be flying international routes because it's more widely available worldwide. Jet B, though, is an alternative type of jet fuel with an even lower freezing point and is commonly used in extremely cold areas. Avgas, or aviation gas, on the other hand, is used primarily by reciprocating engines or piston engines. Avgas, it's been under fire recently, the use of it, because it contains an additive called tetraethyl. We call it TEL. And that's added to prevent engine knock. The same, very similar component to what's in, or additive that is in your car, your vehicle. But why it's been under fire and what my opinions on that specifically, I mean, I'm not a tree hugger, and my views on that are, well, I really have none, to be honest with you. Now, there's two types of avgas. You got 100 and 100 low lead, which is just the difference in the octane rating. Turbine engines, though, they need a fuel that can be easily atomized, combusted, and provides a lubricating quality in a very high heat, high pressure environment, in the addition to having a very high flash point, and we'll discuss that. Because it's important to have fuel with a very low freezing point, because you do not want fuel to freeze. And a classic example of an aviation incident involving freezing fuel was British Airlines Flight 38. And that was a 777 that made an emergency landing due to ice crystallization of the fuel, which clogged the fuel oil heat exchangers in each of its Rolls-Royce Trent 895 engines, which, by the way, are fantastic engines, if you want to know my opinion on that. But having a higher flash point is very, very important. Flash point is the temperature in which a flammable chemical ignites, and then it can turn into a vapor. With jet fuel, you have a very high flash point, and it also offers a very high octane rating. And again, that main point of having a higher flash point is safety. If the flash point is too low, the fuel ignites easier. If it's too high, the fuel doesn't easily combust within the turbine engine. It doesn't provide as much power, if you would. In the flash point composition, it's also determined by its ability to auto-ignite. So the manufacturers of jet fuel, they study the chemical makeup of the fuel very carefully, but it is a trade-off. Either way, though, jet fuel, it's highly regulated and is made, if you would, to minimize risks, yet to be very efficient running in turbine engines. The question of flammability is not as straightforward as you might think, because it requires a pretty lengthy discussion. But the takeaway is this: it's less flammable than gasoline and avgas. So hopefully, Marcus, that answers your question. Thanks so much for writing in. I really do appreciate that. And this next email comes from Mr. Les in Colorado, and I've spoken to Les via email a couple times throughout the years. Really nice guy. And Les writes, "Wheels, why do some planes have two ailerons on each wing, and why not just one? And how do ailerons actually work? I get the kind of sort of physics of it, but how do they work? Is it just cables? And I know you haven't been around lately, but hopefully you get back to me. Thanks." Hey there, Les. Thanks so much for writing in. Like I said, we've spoken a few times, conversed via email. Really nice guy out of there in Colorado. Yeah, I've been absent for a few months, and you can catch up why on the first episode of this year, 2023 update and mini listener questions answered. So let's answer what ailerons do first. The ailerons, they're a primary flight control, and they're used to control the rolling motion or the bank about the longitudinal axis of the aircraft, and that's done via the control wheel or the yoke in the flight deck. And that can use cables, pulleys, hydraulics, or a combination of both. And I actually covered this more in depth in early 2021 in the show's very first Aircraft Tech Talk episode, and then I spoke about it again in the second Aircraft Tech Talk episode in December of 2021. So you might want to take a look at those two previous episodes or take a listen to them. I go a little bit more in depth on the control mechanics behind it. Now, the reason some aircraft have two pairs of ailerons, or a low-speed and a high-speed aileron on each wing, is aircraft speed in relation to the aircraft's control responsiveness. So on larger aircraft, the flight controls become more responsive, but they also become a lot more sensitive as aircraft speed increases. And since ailerons work by manipulating that airflow, a large volume of air flown at a very high speed, it only needs to be deflected a small amount to do the job. The outboard ailerons, they're very sensitive during high speeds. And if the outboard ailerons are used at high speeds, they can generate very high forces and stressors that could damage the wing or cause even a loss of control of the aircraft due to that high sensitivity. Now, a way to reduce the wing stress at high speeds is having a second aileron on each wing position closer to the fuselage, and these are called your high-speed ailerons. And the small moment of force it's called means it doesn't take much force to bank or roll the aircraft, so the most significant contribution of your inboard or your high-speed ailerons is they allow proper roll control at a high speed without bending the wing or putting unnecessary stresses on the airframe. And if you use just outboard ailerons or the low-speed ailerons by themselves, or essentially there were only outboard ailerons on a large aircraft, you would be increasing those stresses, and the roll control of the aircraft would not be really cool at high speeds. Now, not all aircraft have two sets of ailerons on each wing, a low-speed and a high-speed aileron, such as some Airbus aircraft. Even the A380, believe it or not, because that aircraft is a fly-by-wire control system. It's all controlled by, well, a computer. It has a flight control system that very precisely moves the outboard ailerons in relation to speed and pitch and several other factors. And they're completely actuated electronically. And there's no physical link between the control surfaces and the control wheel or the yoke in the flight deck. And this makes the inboard ailerons redundant, i.e., the flight control computer ignores inputs from the pilots when it thinks it's an unsafe condition. So that's how they can get away with that. And that does go into another discussion, a whole nother discussion of whether Boeing aircraft are more or less controllable than Airbus aircraft, though we can talk about that at a later point in time. And heck, if you folks listening have an opinion on that, please feel free to reach out and let me know. And as an added note, one last note there, Les, the low-speed ailerons, they are locked out on aircraft that are equipped with high-speed and low-speed ailerons, because you don't want both of those ailerons working in unison. You want to lock out your outboard ailerons and let the high-speed ones work, and that's determined by speed. That's also determined via the flight control computer, the FCS, on the aircraft. So hopefully, Les, that answers your questions, and really appreciate the email. Good talking to you again. Take care. And as I'm looking at the clock here, we are reaching the time for our obscene sponsor break. So we're going to answer more of your Aircraft Tech Talk questions in part two coming up. Stay tuned. Hey everyone, thanks so much for tuning in to part two of 2023's first Aircraft Tech Talk. I'm really excited to be doing this. We have some great people asking some awesome questions. So let's dive right into part two. This next question comes from Facebook from Samantha. And Samantha wrote me, "Hey Brian, I'm a baggage handler at Airlines and wondering why the Embraer 170's baggage door is always damaged, it seems. We are always getting blamed for a lot of damage to the door. Really frustrating." All right. Well, Samantha, thanks for writing in. Thanks for reaching out. I do feel your pain with the blame game there, and it's always someone's fault, it seems. But okay, in my experience, baggage door damage, or hell, GSE damage on its own, is a lot of it's due to misoperation and not paying attention. And in this case, possibly the same with the Embraer 170 baggage doors. But since he didn't specify what the kind of damage was, I'll say this. The Embraer 170 baggage doors, or the cargo doors, they're pretty much the same as the larger 190 series. And I've seen doors bent at either the piano hinges or gotten gate calls where the seal has been torn and it's gotten wedged in the frame, usually upon closing it. But then again, that makes opening it very difficult, and that encompasses a fair amount of gate calls. Now, those aren't particularly due to ramp operation of the door or other ramp damage. It's wear and tear, and sometimes, though, it could be misuse or improper handling of the door, and it'll cause those seals to twist, and they become damaged and torn as they are twisted around. Now, those doors, they move outward and upward when it's unlocked, and they open pretty much like many other aircraft cargo or baggage doors. And one issue, though, that I have seen caused by misoperation is the vent flap damage to that particular door on the 170s and the 190. If it isn't closed properly, you end up damaging the drive rods and the support shafts that live behind the opening handle and behind the flap, the vent flap mechanism. And another issue that I've seen time and time is the gas spring actuators being damaged if the door is closed on top of like a piece of luggage or hell, even a baggage loader or piece of equipment. But again, he didn't say what type of damage that was being reported that you guys are being hounded about. But remember, the proper way to open those cargo doors is by pushing the ditching button. Okay, it's that big red, well, not big red, but that red button. You push it in, that's opening up the flap vent, and then you're pushing the handle in, then you're pulling on it, and this turns the handle shaft, then lifts the cargo door with that main handle. But I've seen rampers pull on the door vent flap trying to open it, and again, that will cause damage. And I've also seen damage trying to close the door by not pushing the stabilization handle that lives within inside that door. That's what you have to push to, once the door's been opened fully and locked, that's what you have to push in order to close it. I've seen guys pull on it backwards, and what'll happen is kind of very similar to those of you who have worked on maintenance write-ups for the 727 aft tail stair doors. You can over-center it, and then that's a bear to get fixed. And those cargo doors on pretty much every aircraft, they're going to get a lot of abuse either way. And you can tell, if you don't know what a baggage cargo door is or where it's at in the aircraft, just look for the number of dents and scrapes on one of the access doors, and that's very likely your cargo or baggage door. And Samantha, I'm sorry I can't be further help to you. I wish I could, but remember, be safe and be aware of your surroundings out there. I do appreciate you writing in. And next, we have an Airbus A300 question from Dale in Tennessee, and Dale writes, "Brian, we received a gate call for an A300 a while ago, just before my shift ended, and it was only me and two other rather new mechanics. What is the first thing to do for an engine bite test? Thanks. P.S. Love the podcast." Dale, I do appreciate the email, and thank you, sir, for the kudos, and I'm glad you're enjoying the podcast. Now, you didn't say what the discrepancy was, so I can't really comment on that, but remember, you got to always consult the tech pubs. Always consult the tech pubs. They are the God's word on maintenance. Do not troubleshoot or perform any aircraft-based maintenance on what I'm telling you or anyone else here. Always consult the tech pubs. I got to say that. And I'll stop here and tell you a little story. The first year I was a GenFam instructor, I was teaching 37NG classes. I did have a student in class sign off paperwork in the hangar per Brian Wheels GenFam class. No shit. That did happen. Because I didn't specify in class that this is for reference only. Just because I'm telling you, GenFam or otherwise, you always consult the tech pub. So that's why I say that. Now, the general bite procedure for troubleshooting an engine bleed issue on an A300 is the following. Okay, you have to find the bleed LRUs in the E and eBay, the proper ones, and you have an analog test per 36000, and that starts with performing a lamp test, and then you move on to the go lights, and you have a no-go light that shows up after you complete the series of tasks. Then that references you into the FIM for that particular sensor. Then you troubleshoot the indicated system. But you have to remember to return the switch to the flight position. And that is also the same on the 767. Do not arbitrarily change the LRU indicated. I know shotgunning is a thing, especially on the line, but the line is a little bit different situation. These tests, they're only indicating the faulty system, because faults can and usually do include wiring and or sense or muscle line problems. Muscle line problems being your pneumatic line problems or your pneumatic actuated or electrically actuated pneumatic valves. So you might be changing controllers, sensors, valves, or slew of other possibilities. You will also find the tech pub's bite procedure for the bleed controllers as well mentioned. And this is done by scrolling through the fault data sequentially. And again, there's several possibilities of what could be wrong. You could have a high pressure regulator, the fan air valve, the high pressure sensors, the regulator's pressure sensors. There's some temp sensors, a high pressure relief valve, a pressure regulating valve. There's a whole bunch of stuff that could be the problem. And you're going to find that a lot of that in AMM 3611-19. And that has further tests But again, without knowing the exact write-up, I can only suggest general things, but I have to stress, always consult the tech pubs. The A300 aircraft, though, does have a history, long-running, irritating history of bleed control problems or bleed air problems. And in my experience, there's several things. The high-pressure valve. The high-pressure valve, especially the V225 valves, they are notorious. And 36-11-19, the AMM, will direct you to perform testing on the leads of these valves. And many times what I found is the pneumatic controller that's commanding the valve closed or open is at fault. But sometimes, you know, while you're determining if the high pressure valve itself is physically opening and closed, it might not be. And you can find that as a problem as well. And there's also been failures of the fire handle itself, the switch in it, not sending the signal to the bleed switch. And at that juncture in the troubleshooting, you're checking continuity, I believe, between things like pins 4 and 14 or pins 4, and it's two different pins. Essentially, you're looking for an open to ground condition if you suspect that the switch in the fire handle itself is not talking to the bleed switch. Also, the order that I've seen on A300s is the high stage temp sensors. And you have to do those tests at the ambient temperature. And again, you're testing the pins and how many ohms you're getting. And that's located on the 14th stage of the engine. And that is, I believe it's sensor T3. That's Thomas 3. As a general caution, though, for all engine sensors, and this is for anybody listening, make sure you're making the repairs with Alumel, Chromel wiring, pins, terminals, etc. And the AMM will, of course, tell you to go to IPC to see exactly what parts and materials you're using. And the reason why, if people out there don't know, Alumel and Chromel, that material is to withstand high heat because especially on the 14th stage of a turbine engine or this turbine engine, you're going to have very, very high heat. So you don't want to be installing wiring, terminals, pins, sensors, etc., components that are susceptible to being damaged by high heat. So that's why that's very important. And one last thing to note, because I have a sneaking suspicion someone's going to try and call me out on this. The values, they're not absolute. They may vary. However, in general, unusually high or low readings indicate a wiring or a sensor problem in my experience. But again, without knowing the exact problem you have, I can only surmise what I would think, but I have to stress, always consult the tech pubs. Thanks so much for writing in, Dale. And please let me know if you hear this, reach out. Let me know what did you guys find? What was your solution? I'd be interested in hearing that. And this next question comes from a person who left no name or location. I only have an email address and I actually reached out to them and say, hey, could you provide me maybe your first name so I could use it on the podcast? And I didn't receive a response. So it's a no name, no location. Their question reads, where's the outflow valve on a 767? I was told they don't have any by a friend. Is that true? Well, Mr. No Name or Mrs. No Name, that's not true. The 767 does have an outflow valve and it's located just aft of the bulk cargo compartment. And it's a typical dual gate type of valve that has both an AC and a DC motor for backup on it. Now, any aircraft flying higher than 10,000 feet, it needs to be pressurized. And to maintain pressure in the cabin, an outflow valve or a pressurization valve is used. And what that's doing, it's releasing air at a regulated rate to maintain your cabin altitude, the pressurization within the cabin of the aircraft. And that's usually somewhere for 8,000 feet to less. And the exact figures, they do differ from aircraft type to aircraft type, though. The general rule of thumb is you're maintaining that cabin altitude at 8,000 feet or less. That's what they have found through studies is most comfortable for us humans. So your friend wasn't correct, unfortunately. Mr. No Name or Mrs. No Name, I do appreciate the email. Thanks for reaching out. And this next message I received comes from Kathy in California. Kathy is a spicy one. Now I'll just listen. So Kathy writes, you do know that those clouds airplanes leave behind in the skies are poisonous, right? Too bad you don't tell the truth, misleading the public again. Explain to me why small planes then don't create these disastrous pollutants. All right, Kathy, I appreciate your email and sorry, sweetie, but I disagree with you. In my opinion, chemtrails or contrails, they don't hurt the bees, the birds, the sky, or the trees, or us humans. But you're in California, so it makes sense why you would think that anyways. Those white clouds you see in the sky trailing behind aircraft, it's a naturally occurring water vapor. That's it. It's not exhaust. It's not pollutants. There's no conspiracies behind it. It's naturally occurring water vapor that makes a cloud. A clown. I said clown. A cloud. It makes a clown. Yeah, it makes a clown out of the conspiracists. Ha! It makes a cloud. So again, contrary to what the tree huggers believe, those white clouds, they're due to condensation. And this condensation is simply formed when the hot exhaust temperature from that aircraft engine is meeting humid, cool air at a very high altitude. So as water forms in the air behind the plane, cold temperature at high altitude, it's going to freeze then, and it's going to remain in the form of a cloud or a trail or a vapor. It's just that simple. And this does, though, depend on the environmental conditions within the air. That's why sometimes you see them, sometimes you don't. And again, those conditions are your temperature, humidity at whatever height that plane is flying at. The rule of thumb is the more humid the air, the longer the vapor trails will last. And why don't all aircraft leave chemtrails or contrails? It's simply a combination of those variables. Again, temperature, humidity, moisture content aloft. Why a Cessna 150 with a reciprocating engine doesn't produce them? Because it's a reciprocating engine. Yeah. So this brings me back to several tweets on the old twatter where the people were blaming Boeing for purposely producing aircraft that pollute the air more than Airbus. And that's nothing more than your typical anti-Boeing troll going on about big, bad Boeing, whose aircraft are the only ones created to make these big pollutant-causing trails. And that's horseshit. And are these trails dangerous? They're not. It's water vapor. It's a cloud. And I explained why. It's a fallacy created to push environmental agendas. So, Kathy, I hope this clears things up to you, and I wish one of these days you'd step out of California into reality. So, God bless. In his next email, this comes from Jonathan H. in Missouri. And Jonathan writes, Mr. Brian Wheels, can you tell me why flights are delayed for tray tables that are broke? Is it really a big deal? Are tray tables vitally important to aircraft mechanically? Because if I'm in an airplane crash, there's bigger things that would kill me, right? Jonathan, thank you for reaching out. And tray tables, they do not serve a mechanical function or purpose to the aircraft. They are a tray table, a table to place whatever on. That's it. Now, as far as the safety aspect, tray tables, they are by design, again, by design, made to fragment upon impact so they don't impale you. A broken tray table, it's not really hurting anything. It's not hurting the aircraft, but the concern is that tray table blocking someone's egress in an emergency off the aircraft. And you don't want a tray table that wasn't rectified, repaired, replaced, MEL, get in the way. When folks are already trying to squeeze their way out of these small spaced seats, when you don't want it blocking the aisle or the emergency exit only. And it definitely is frustrating to wait on maintenance to fix on a broken table when you're on your way out or you think you're on your way out. I can relate to that frustration, and I've had several people yell and cuss at me when I've responded to a gay call for a broken tray table, because I'm like, what the hell? You know, we're seriously sitting here because of a tray table, and yeah, I've gotten yelled at by folks for it. And they're really not hard to remove or MEL, but it just takes up time, and it always seems to occur at the last minute or right before pushback. And why? Well, cabin crew, they don't always notice it, and sometimes it's not brought to their attention quick enough, and sometimes the cabin crew just didn't look. I have met aircraft at the gate for an inbound discrepancy and waited for the passengers to depart. And the next 40 minutes, the cabin crew and the flight crew or the oncoming flight crew, they're just bullshitting. And that's all they're doing is just bullshitting. So, I mean, there's some reasons why. Believe me, it frustrates me. I've been a passenger in that situation. But the majority of time, it also frustrates the cabin crew or the flight crew or both, because they are not there to purposely inconvenience you. They want to be on their way too. You know, a lot of these folks are working 10, 12-hour shifts, maybe even more. And if you're a pilot out there or a flight attendant, Yeah, reach out to me. Let me know what ridiculous hours are you working. I'd be interested in hearing that from you. Yeah, you don't want the tray tables becoming a hindrance if you're trying to evacuate the aircraft. You don't want it causing a problem. And yes, I agree. There's many, many more things that could possibly injure or kill you during an incident or an accident. It's just one of those things you got to go through, has to be rectified, and you got to go with the flow sometimes. And Jonathan, I do appreciate you reaching out. Thanks so much. Well, folks, I do hope that you enjoyed this year's 2023's first Aircraft Tech Talk segment. I really do love these segments. It excites me. I love speaking to you folks and helping you out. And if you have any aircraft tech type questions or any questions in general, thoughts, concerns, or if you want to share your stories and experiences live on the podcast, reach out to me, apmechanicpodcast@aol.com. You can also find me on Twitter at goodbadugly_AMP. Also on Facebook, Good Bad Ugly AP, one word. And remember, new podcast second Wednesday of each month. Keep those emails and messages coming. I do appreciate you folks. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, take care and be safe. We'll see you.